My name is Paul Olson, and this is a session on African-American literature.
I'm going to have you do a little exercise before we start. And you can write these down if you want to, or you just remember them. I'd like to have you think of five adjectives or nouns that you would use to describe yourself. For example, not really, so, well, whatever you choose to do. But for example, if I were going to tell you, here are my five adjectives. I am a father, a husband, a teacher, a runner. No, I'm not a runner. A jogger. used to be a runner. Those kinds of things. You know, whatever you think would apply to you. Think of five adjectives that describe who you are. And I guess I'd prefer not to have you think hard about that. The first five things that come to mind, really. Everybody's got them already? Let's throw out what some of those are. What did you say? You know, in this short time, you don't have much time to think and get profound. What?
A woman.
A woman.
Grandmother.
Grandmother.
Mother.
Mother. Grandfather.
Musician.
Musician. Teacher.
Norwegian.
Norwegian. Oh. Who said that?
I did.
And then she says, first she says Norwegian, and then she says it even more, with even more pride. You check her out here. No, I don't want your hand. Sweet, I'll shake your hand.
It's too late.
Retired.
Intelligent.
Older.
Lover. Not old, older.
Senior.
What was, I have another one, lover? Lover.
Woo.
All right, we're going to stop now. What? I heard some more.
Athletic.
White. We'll stop there. I do that exercise. I teach at Augustana State College in Rock Island, Illinois, when I'm not out here and other places. And I teach two different courses, among other things. I teach two different courses in African-American literature. And you can walk in front of me. It's okay. It's just that you'll have a hard time passing the quiz now. I give that exercise to my students at Augustana in these two different classes every year. And it is always the same result, and it has been since I started that in 1970. White students never put down white. And black students always put down black. And now that term has changed, and we can get into that if you want to African-American. But that recognition of heritage, that recognition of that part of their identity is always mentioned. And it's, again, never mentioned by white kids, students, that they're white. Why do you suppose that is?
Because they make them aware of their color.
Okay, and we is?
White.
We are?
Caucasian.
So there's some kind of awareness. Of racial identity that we don't have. It's unusual. If you weren't at Holden, you probably wouldn't have said Norwegian. You know, but you were here.
I think he would.
Where are you from?
California.
Okay. Oh, no wonder you said it. There are no Norwegians in California. If you moved to Minnesota, then...
It's a minority in California.
Okay, there's some kind of awareness, and there's something about it, as you said it nicely. We make them aware of that. And, okay, we'll just leave that observation that we just made here in a minute and a half there, up there on the board. There's something about our society that does that and creates a consciousness about racial identity that white people don't have. We had a wonderful presenter here a week ago, Dorothy Hall from the Urban Studies Program in Chicago, who gave several sessions on white privilege. And the whole idea, not the whole idea, but one of the main ideas of those kinds of sessions was to just point out how often we just take for granted all the things we do. For instance, the simple things like walking into a grocery store and just being able to walk up and down the aisles without anybody asking you, can I help you? Or checking up on to see if you're going to pocket some stuff. Or we walk into a bank to check out, you know, take out a loan on our house, and we don't imagine that we're going to be refused, do we?
Or go to a Denny's restaurant and get served.
Yeah, or the most popular right now, go to a Denny's, and to think, it doesn't even cross our mind. And that's a privilege that we live with. Okay, Exercise number one. Exercise number two is over. Exercise number two, something that I asked in the last session we had, does it matter, and how do you think it matters? Only you put yourself into the situation that I am now going to put myself. My great-grandfather was a Norwegian carpenter. And I have a good friend back in Rock Island whose great-grandfather, or probably have to go great-great-grandfather, was a slave. How does that matter today, generations later? How do we think it does?
We think of it as a stigma.
Part of that awareness. I mean, we sure have made that become, I mean, it's not, yeah, that's right. Okay, we'll leave it. I'm interested not in what, just what our assessment is, yes.
Well, that also created an economic reality that, and a culture with that reality for your different families that provided different opportunities that have worked their way out to you and your friends.
So my grandfather's a carpenter and his is a slave. Can anybody, you can too, be specific about conjecturing on what kind of economic reality that might create? We'll speculate.
Well, you start with nothing, and theoretically, your grandfather started with something. So you start with a negative.
Yeah.
Situation.
Annoying question mark.
But also, I think, doesn't it say something about where do you come from? Tell me about your tradition. Tell me about your family.
So, tell
me about the riches of your Western European heritage.
Family riches, and I put it in quotes because I don't think you mean money. You mean, you said the riches of traditions and so on. Yeah, that's good. Anybody else?
I think it seems to me like the most important thing would be the fact that your great grandfather who was a carpenter had rights where the person who was a slave had no rights, which had nothing to do really with money.
Nothing to do with money. And it had nothing to do with what else? Ability? Money, we'll just list a couple of these. Intelligence?
Right.
You tell me, keep going.
Worth?
Is that what I heard?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What do you mean by that?
Well, some of them were looked on as less than human.
Yeah. Well, it was law. Everybody knows this, don't you? The 3/5. That's how when they took the census polls, they counted a slave as 3/5 of a person. I just finished reading, just today, a pretty wonderful book, The Gathering of Old Men by Ernest Gaines. It was a movie video that wasn't as good as the book. I guess, well, that's pretty often true. But one character, I just remember, he I don't want to give away the plot because this comes away at the end, if you should decide to read it. He fires his gun anyway, and he said, I'm 50, and I'm a half a century old, and I ought to be able to be called Mr. Bartlett, not Charlie. And for that, the whole sense of that, and this guy's grown up in the South, I just mentioned that it has to do with the sense of worth. You can call me Mr. And he says, I've been calling you Missy, and I've been calling you Mr. for 50 years, and now it's your turn. Okay, anything else?
It seems that the white man would come into this situation, or your grandfather, with a Western European culture, however old, and the person with a slave as the great-grandfather or grandfather would come in with whatever family background he had, which would be African, quite a different type of culture. Or there would be no.
Or that's even the better observation, no. Probably more accurate. There'd be no cultural heritage until it gets get a chance to
whatever remnants were left within the slave system.
Yeah. So, now, no cultural heritage is a phrase we have to be careful about because there really is.
True.
You're right, I know what you're saying. And there's a rich cultural heritage among African Americans. But the white structure did whatever they could to blot that out and to erase and to give no sense of foundation, so that we really have this whole image of part of what the slave image is this wandering Jew, this wandering Exodus with no land somehow and with no promised land to go to. So if we want, we can take that comparison and compare that image to the biblical Jews escaping slavery from Egypt, but they have a promise. And it's an altogether different kind of anticipation, isn't it? Well, there is anticipation, and there isn't here. But we'll come back to this cultural heritage thing as we look at Frederick Douglass. And, yeah?
I think a different sense of the American dream. I mean, for yeah. your great-grandfather, they might have told the kids, you know, you if you work hard, you can be almost anything. You know? And the American dream might not be have been taught as a reality within a family that had slavery.
Yeah. I have a book at home. I don't even move it anymore. It's so old. I don't even know how I got possession of it. It's about this thick, and it's called The Slave Code of Tennessee. It's this thick, 8 by 11. Again, this thick of laws just for Tennessee on how slaves will be handled and how legally they will be transported, treated. I mean, you name it. You can imagine if it's that thick what it covers. The American dream is not something out there that I can imagine. We'll just cross off American dream, and I think we can put nightmare. Because it's all spelled out. If you do this, this is the consequence. If you do this, this is the consequence. Whereas my grandpa said, if I build this house, I might make a little profit, and maybe I could build two, and so on. That's a good observation. Yeah.
Well, but also the sense of personal pride that your grandfather probably had, and that would be difficult to have as a slave.
Yeah. Because there's nothing that you can do to build pride in. It's good.
I'd like to suggest, too, that we consider this as the same situation we did with the American Indian.
Yeah.
And not just the black.
I am not, I'll put indigenous peoples. I'm far from an expert. I mean, I don't know anything, I guess, about the indigenous peoples of America. More, I know what you guys know, probably. Admitting that right off the top, then I would suggest, you're right, and there are lots of parallels, mm-hmm. for sure. There's one major difference.
They were here.
Yeah.
Well, they were here. That is, okay, there's two major differences. Then you keep coming up with the wrong answer, I was three, four.
They weren't slaves, were they?
That's right, they weren't slaves.
Yeah.
And they weren't owned. They were treated like dirt, and we can go into that as much as we could collectively analyze and put together our knowledge and what we know about. But they weren't owned. They weren't, here's the word, C-H-A-T-T-E-L, chattel. I mean, it comes from the word cattle. I mean, the Old English, I mean, you look up an Old English dictionary, and that's where this comes from. That means property, of course, and property means... If you are property, you surely can't own property. If you are property, you surely don't have any rights. So then we go back to, I'm not sure the date, and I'll put it down like this with a question mark, but it's somewhere late in the 17th century in America. Now the first slave ship came over to America in 1619. Let me rattle off some dates for you to get a sense of, is this in the fiber, in the bone marrow of our culture and of our country, or is it the first European ship to land in America came when? Anybody know that from your U.S. history?
1607.
I heard it. 1607. Name? Jamestown. Right? Okay. Pilgrims?
1620.
Look at this. Before the Pilgrims came for religious freedom, we're told, we had a slave ship land in America. 1619 is the first slave ship. Well, later in that century, and get these down, you're not taking notes, you guys, and there's a quiz at the end. Okay, there's no quiz. As 14 people get up, start walking out. Later in the century, there's an issue with indentured servants. There are three of them that escape. Everybody know, what's an indentured servant? And we all know that.
They sold themselves into slavery for X amount of time for X amount of dollars.
Yep. Typically for passage over here, and it's a limited kind of slavery or servanthood, and it is, how many years?
Seven.
That's right, 7 years.
But they could add on and add on years to that too.
They could, yeah. And then sometimes they could work their way out of short, but that's pretty general, the fee, and that's what we know. Okay. In Maryland, late in, or about the middle of the 17th century, early in our country's, you know, rape of the land, if you, I won't say that,
conquest.
I wasn't going to use conquest either. Our settling of this wilderness. And I say that with my tongue in my cheek, how can a wilderness be where people live and so on. Three indentured servants escaped. Two white guys and a black guy named John Punch. This is a famous episode in American law now. And they were all caught and they were all brought to court. And the judge, all three were indentured servants. The judge's penalty was this. The two white guys had to serve their individual owners or loaners, you know, those guys who had them on loan really for those 7 years. They had to serve their owners for 7 more years and then do 3 years service to the entire community. John Punch was sentenced to slavery for life. There's no reason. The crime was the same. My point is, it even begins to work its way deliberately into the structure of law with the irrationality of prejudice. There's no rat. I mean, this guy didn't go out and escape and kill three people. They escaped and got caught. John Punch, you can remember that. Well, I bring up all of that with this whole sense of the kinds of things that we're talking about with the legacy of slavery and some of the things that get that legacy started. And we'll see now, and we'll look at this right now, how the truths of the narratives that we read connect us in 1993 to a kind of cultural racism. And I guess now I remember the title. Remember what it is? Conflict within and conflict between. And I suspect that lots of us are working on both levels. That's, we have this conflict within too. And you know, well, I have this. And we can begin to see where how some of that gets worked out as we look at some slave narratives. Before I do that, one last part of an introduction. A personal note. It was 1960 and I was a junior in high school. And at that time, the most important role model in my life was my history teacher and my football and basketball coach. And he was a great guy. He was gentle. He was athletic. He was loving. He was a wonderful teacher. He was a wonderful humanitarian. He was a very important man in my life. And he stood in front of our U.S. history course in 1960 and said, "You know, slavery really wasn't so bad." Okay. This is one of the greatest guys in my life, and I guess slavery wasn't so bad. And then later in my own academic pursuits, I learned that in 1919, I'm making a connection here that may not be historically true, but it perhaps can be metaphorically true, and that's truth enough. In 1919, a guy named Ulrich Phillips, who was white, made what he called a definitive study of American Negro slavery and titled a book just that, American Negro Slavery, Ulrich Phillips. It's 519 pages long. It has about 700 footnotes. The definitive book on American Negro slavery written in 1919 called American Negro Slavery didn't have one single footnote referring to a black woman or man. And then I read a slave narrative in which the narrator said, "'Tis not he who looks on who can describe slavery, mm-hmm. but he who has endured." And now, you know, published in 1984, we can say she who has endured as well. There are slave narratives written by women too. Not so many, but I have one with me. So, I connect that historical fact in 1919. We've got this book that's trying to describe slavery, and it says, and it's written by a white guy who doesn't use any black sources. But what he does do is he goes to, and he's proud of this as an historian. At the end of his book, he describes his whole historical process and said, you can't just go to old history books, you have to go to public records and journals, and he did. So he went to courthouses and to church records and to personal journals and all kinds of things, and he came up with a conclusion, as his last paragraph says, one could travel, I suspect, as far south down the Shenandoah as I did, and even farther, before he would come upon an uncontented slave. And then about 40 years later, a history teacher says to me, a good guy now, that matters.
slavery really wasn't so bad. Where do we get that? Probably from he who has looked on, not from he who has endured. I've read since then, since this 1960 date, lots and lots and lots of slave narratives. Let me tell you that there is not one single slave narrative that says anything good about slavery. No matter how they were treated, no matter if they were the highest house nigger, I'm using that word as they would, or the lowest field nigger, doesn't matter. Slavery is absolutely, unequivocally awful. I say unequivocally, underline that to give the sense to it. Communism is pretty bad stuff, but not unequivocally evil. Right? I mean, we read about the theory of communism. There's got some sense behind that. We can look at different kinds of economic and social structures, and they're not unequivocally evil. Nazism perhaps is. But slavery, unequivocal. It's an absolute. And that judgment comes from this whole sense of what he who has endured says about it. Okay, what I thought we'd do is we've started with these kinds of guesses at some of the effects of slavery. I'd like to read several passages. Only one is long, and by long I mean about 3 minutes. And then I'll read one, and then we'll observe what we think is sort of the attitude and the idea of that passage. And I'll write your ideas about their ideas on the board, and then we'll step back at the end of these and kind of look collectively at all the things that we've observed about different things that slaves have said about the conditions of slavery. Okay, what I mean by all that will be clear right now. This is from the narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass. It's probably the most famous slave narrative. And it's in our library. Well, it's not in our library, it's in my hand right now. But it's not in my hand, it's in our library, okay? And this book, the other one I'll be reading from, Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, is also in our library when it's not in my hand. But it's also, we have a few copies in the bookstore, if you're interested in Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, a real unusual book, because most all slave narratives are written by men that exist. I was born in Tuckahoe near Hillsboro and about 12 miles from Easton in Talbot County, Maryland. I have no accurate knowledge of my age. What I want you to get from this now is, this is the longest excerpt right here. It's just this, what do you sense out of this? What do you, not, what you think, and you heard me last night, I guess, on poetry, some of you did. This literary criticism or literary analysis that we're going to do, again, starts from the guts. So just, what's the feeling you get from this? I have no accurate knowledge of my age, never having seen any authentic record containing it. By far, the larger part of the slaves know as little of their ages as horses know of theirs. And it is the wish of most masters within my knowledge to keep their slaves thus ignorant. I do not remember to have ever met a slave who could tell of his birthday. They seldom come nearer to it than planting time, harvest time, cherry time, spring time, or fall time. A want of information concerning my own was a source of unhappiness to me, even during childhood. I will say one other thing. A lot of this stuff is, and more so with Linda Brennan, is written with kind of a Victorian understatement. It's just the way stuff got written then. You know, and what made me say that is this phrase, the want of information concerning my own was a source of unhappiness. Now that's kind of a euphemism. It's a lot more than a source of unhappiness, but that's 19th century writing by blacks and whites, pretty much. It was a want of a want of information concerning my own was a source of unhappiness to me, even during childhood. The white children could tell their ages. I could not tell why I ought to be deprived of the same privilege. I was not allowed to make any inquiries of my master concerning it. He deemed all such inquiries on the part of a slave improper and impertinent and evidence of a restless spirit. The nearest estimate I can give makes me now between 27 and 28 years of age. I come to this from hearing my master say sometime during 1835 that I was about 17. My mother was named Harriet Bailey. She was the daughter of Isaac and Betsy Bailey, both colored and quite dark.
My mother was of a darker complexion than either my grandfather or grandmother. My father was a white man. He was admitted to be such by all I ever heard speak of my parentage. The opinion was also whispered that my master was my father. But of the correctness of this opinion, I know nothing. The means of knowing was withheld from me. My mother and I were separated when I was but an infant, before I knew her as my mother. It is a common custom in the part of Maryland from which I ran away to part children from their mothers at a very early age, frequently before the child has reached its 12th month. Its mother is taken from it and hired out on some farm a considerable distance off, and the child is placed under the care of an old woman, too old for field labor. For what this separation is done, I do not know, unless it be to hinder the development of the child's affection toward its mother, and to blunt and destroy the natural affection of the mother for the child. In any case, this is the inevitable result. I never saw my mother, to know her as such, more than 4 or 5 times in my life, and each of these times was for very short in duration and at night. She was hired by a Mr. Stewart who lived about 12 miles from my home. She made her journeys to see me in the night, traveling the whole distance on foot after the performance of her day's work. She was a field hand, and a whipping is the penalty of not being in the field at sunrise, unless a slave has special permission from his or her master to the contrary, a permission which they seldom get, by the way, and one that gives to him that gives it the proud name of being a kind master. I do not recollect of ever seeing my mother by the light of day. She died when I was about 7 years old on one of my master's farms near Lee's Mill. I was not allowed to be present during her illness, at her death, or burial. She was gone long before I knew anything about it. Never having enjoyed to any considerable extent her soothing presence, her tender and watchful care, I received the tidings of her death with much the same emotions I should have probably felt at the death of a stranger. Last short paragraph. Called thus suddenly away, she left me without the slightest intimation of who my father was. The whisper that my master was my father, may or may not be true, and true or false, it is of but little consequence to my purpose, whilst the fact remains in all its glaring odiousness, that slaveholders have ordained and by law established that the children of slave women shall in all cases follow the condition of their mothers. Excerpt number one, and none of the rest of them are that long. Your feelings and your thoughts both about that guy. Yes.
He felt he was dehumanized.
And the process of that dehumanization is, I mean, what?
The denial of his rights as a child and his mother's rights as a mother.
Humans have mothers and they know their mothers and they get to be fondled and cuddled by their mothers. And yes, good. Yeah.
Except for the pain that he's suffering and going through, how does he even know that he exists? I mean, there's so little there.
That's a pretty philosophical observation. We're going to write it down. Pain is the, I'll put predominant emotion of selfhood. When what makes you know you exist, you know, we have a joke about that. You just, you know, man, I never knew I had muscles like this, right? You make the hike. I didn't know I had those muscles. Well, without the pain, you wouldn't know you had this leg. That's a pretty interesting kind of analogy. Okay, keep going.
Just a very basic item of information. His own age was even denied him. And every little 2-year-old, if you say, "How old are you, honey?" and the 2 little fingers will go up, you know. But such a basic little bit of information to even deny him that.
So I'm writing 2 things down because one we've already got there. A basic humanity and a basic socialization process, too. Doesn't happen. And that's a nice illustration. How old are you, honey? I don't know.
Or not even knowing who his father was, or not quite sure.
Yeah.
Seemed pretty systematic.
Ooh.
A very systematic dehumanization.
And very effective.
His comparing himself to the treatment and the ownership of the horse was interesting. The horse has his papers. The horse knows how old he is, or someone does. Whereas that is meaning a lot. Of course, that's probably just a tool of control.
Well, self-comparison to animals, they are property. And we had that up there going horizontal, shell.
Two things occur to me. One is the first question I have would be, how did a man like Douglas, under those circumstances, raise himself to the point where he did, from the bottom of the bottom to being writing books and being quite well known?
Yeah.
The next thing that occurs to me is the blacks being treated as they have over the many years that they have, there isn't more hatred on their part, not only for the whites, but also for the country, for the United States.
Yeah. I will write down for what you said, seeds of, and I'll put it in quotes, hatred, I mean, of an unjust system of pretty awful treatment by white people. And then the question of how, you know, how does a guy make it out of that? That's a very long answer, and the quickest answer I can give is you need to read the whole narrative to see how exceptional it is to make it. Not that Douglas is an exceptionally bright man. There are other exceptionally bright men out there, but he also had a whole lot of luck. He got into this master, and this master said, "I'm going to teach you how to read," or it was a mistress. And she started to teach him, and she got quite a ways along before her master, or her husband, his master, found out about it and said, you can't do that, you got to stop. Well, he was lucky, you know, for a while. And then that got him started, and then and it just, the turns all kind of happened at the right time. So it's both the, I ask a different question. I mean, that, you asked a very good and appropriate question, and I asked that too, and I also asked, how many other Frederick Douglasses were there? Who didn't stumble into? I mean, this guy writes like a genius. He's got great social analyzing skills as he looks at the society and the government and everything. How many other out there were like that, but didn't stumble into the right spot at the right time? Anything else? Yeah.
Paul, it's kind of interesting to me that you asked originally about our gut, and here we are, and that's all. Near as I can see, except for pain, that's all ideas.
Yeah,
I feel anger.
Mm-hmm. We're going to write that in green. We'll write all our emotions in green. That's kind of appropriate, isn't it? And that's good. It's good that you bring that up, and it's good that we keep track of that, because, we'll see how that'll change as we go along. I mean, anger is one of the things.
I'm not clear whether Douglas as a child felt that he was, it sounds like he was significantly different than white children. I mean, somehow he was a child and he wasn't a white child.
Yeah.
And whether he was thought of himself as a different species as a child, or whether he's reflecting on this, and so it is there's an identity issue.
Yeah.
Am I a human or not?
Yeah. That's a great point. And that makes autobiography, when I get into that, that makes autobiography a little bit confusing, because autobiography, by its very nature, is told through the eyes of this adult trying to look through the eyes of a child, and you've got two perspectives going on at once. One of the things we know is that he was troubled by, the white kids knew how old they were, and they had birthdays, and they knew their fathers, and I didn't. On the other hand, we know from child abuse cases that kids who move out of a child abuse home into another one, just think, I thought that was the way it was. I mean, I thought that was the nature of family life. So this confused identity that I guess this is how life is. I don't have a mother. Nobody does. But he does know that somebody does. Nobody knows her, but they do. Nobody knows. So you bring up, I think, a profound consequence and a good point about just the effect already from go of slavery. It's good.
I felt the sadness. He accepted it. He was sad about it, but he really didn't think he could do much about it.
Yeah. Well, and for sure. And that's a common thing throughout slave narratives. What can we do? I'll slip away into another historical episode of 1831. Nat Turner stages his great revolt. And the big thing about the Nat Turner Revolt for the whites was to keep it quiet. Because the longer we, these slaves just know that this is the way it is, you know, then there is no hope. There is just kind of this is the way that the world is. It's we do have in our library the journal of Fanny Kimball, who is an English actress who came to America to act because thought she could get more money, and they were in debt back home, and she and her father came here. She hit the stage big in the 1830s, 1840s, and married a guy at the time that she married. She didn't know that his wealth came from owning slaves in Georgia. Well, in her journal, she writes about going down to Georgia to live with him, and she couldn't do it. She was anti-slavery from go, and when she saw slavery, that's what her journal is all about. I bring that up. Why do I bring that up? I lost my point.
Sadness.
Yeah, but it had to do with...
Nat Turner.
Yeah, thank you. Nat Turner. Thank you, that's it. It's Nat Turner. Mm-hmm. On Fanny Kimball's husband's plantation, there was one white guy and 700 slaves. And they didn't revolt. Now figure that out. Well, that's another illustration of the power of oppression, and that's why they sure didn't want to get the Nat Turner revolt out of, gee, maybe we could revolt, maybe we can have success in this. The first thing the white people did when they caught Nat Turner was, don't tell anybody. I mean, that was the word out in the community of Jerusalem and Cortland and the cities that were involved. Okay, good. Sadness and hopelessness. Well, let's go on. Some of the physical conditions of slavery that... I'm going to make these real short because this is profound, but in some ways it's the least of things. The wife of Mr. Giles Hicks, living but a short distance from where I used to live, murdered my wife's cousin, a young girl between 15 and 16 years. She had been set that night to mind Mrs. Hicks's baby, and during the night she fell asleep and the baby cried. She, having lost her rest for several nights previous, did not hear the crying. Okay, this little slave girl, 15 years old, is taking care of the white baby, and the baby's crying, she didn't hear it. They were both in the room with Mrs. Hicks. Mrs. Hicks, finding the girl slow to move, jumped from her bed, seized an oak stick of wood by the fireplace, and with it broke the girl's nose and breastbone, and thus ended her life. I will not say that this most horrid murder produced no sensation in the community. It did produce sensation, but not enough to bring the murderess to punishment. There was a warrant issued for her arrest, but it was never served. Thus, she escaped not only punishment, but even the pain of being arraigned before a court for her horrid crime. There's another story in here where he tells about a slave who went fishing down on the river on his master's property, and they weren't biting, so he just kind of wandered up river and all of a sudden ended up on somebody else's property. The owner came down and shot him. And he tells about this, he gives the names and everything of the owners, the two owners and the slave, and the owner that shot him came over to the guy who owned him and exchanged some money, and it was never talked about again. We see some words up here about dehumanization and property, and geez, I wrecked your wagon. I mean, here, go buy another one. I killed your slave. Here, go buy another one. Your feelings about that, let's see if I have any more. No. The murder of the slave, the girl, and the guy that goes fishing. Just your thoughts. Are they the same? Yes.
Well, it reminds me of the anger recently with the police treatment of black people, that the blacks say, whitey can get away with it again.
Yeah. So from go, there's no justice.
There must have been a feeling of futility. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can't imagine, at some point, like you said, the odds of 1 to 500, and I often thought about this in the camps in Germany, where, you know, where maybe there's only 12 guards and there's 400 people and they're putting them to death. Why didn't one person? Because they must have, in their own minds, they were so... they didn't feel like they could act.
Yeah. There's a book by Stanley Elkins that's called, Slavery. And in that book, Stanley Elkins writes a chapter comparing the slave mentality of the Jews going to the gas chambers to the slaves in American Negro slavery. And the concrete illustration out of that chapter I remember best is that the Jews had to ask permission to go to the bathroom to carry out this very animal biological function. And what the Nazis were so careful about, and they wrote about it, they knew about it, I mean, they were deliberate about this, that someone would come and say, can I go to the bathroom? And they'd say, no. And then 10 minutes later, they'd say, okay, now you can go. So the issue wasn't that they wouldn't let them, you know, eliminate. The issue was, I've got absolute control even over your biological functions. And the effect of that over weeks at a time just seemed to diminish that whole sense of revolt that I can't, you know, I have to even ask permission to go to the bathroom. And you're right, that just contributes to that whole sense of your word, or was it your word, futility, and your word? Okay.
We're just good friends.
Good. Well, we just, great minds run in the same town. You were thinking and he said it. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Overwhelming feeling of shame and being
wow. Mm-hmm. You want to talk about that one at all, or develop it, or let anybody?
You know, to be treated like that, to be shamed on a regular basis, you would take leave.
Yeah.
You know, and just to feel just continually not good enough, not, you know, that feeling, just being ashamed of whatever, of being ashamed of who you are.
Yeah.
You know, just continually. Knowing that you weren't white and that you could never be white.
Yeah.
And, you know, so.
Are you saying that you hear it so often that you just buy into it?
Well, it's not a question of buying into it, it's reality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's nothing you buy into. I mean,
they don't have any choice for this.
No, you didn't have a choice. I mean, for some reason, you were born into this system where what you were was bad. And there's nothing you could do to get out of it.
Yeah.
And there's another thing that I think brings out what Verlana is saying, and that is that I know back in the 50s and the 60s, if a black man wanted to become popular, and Nat King Cole was one of them, he had to become white to do it. He couldn't be himself. And that, I mean, that to me is one of the biggest put downs that you possibly have. Become, when you're black and you have to become white to be successful. I was just listening to Verlana over there, and I was thinking that when he's talking, what he's saying has much more importance than what all the rest of us can say, because he can speak from experience where we can't.
Yeah.
All we can do is speak as outsiders.
Yeah.
And he has the true feelings. We have no idea at all, concept of what he has gone through.
Yep. I wrote this word, a color adjustment. It's a video you can rent, or you can write PBS stations. About the history, I thought it was Nat King Cole, about the history of the image of the black woman and man in television. And that Nat King Cole was the first and only guy to make it in prime time because he pretty much did white kind of music and stuff too. And then this whole color adjustment thing takes it right up to 1991, I think, about what you had to do to... Yeah. It relates to this whole idea of shame. Good.
We know about young kids who have been victims of sexual abuse that somehow, unknown way, they take responsibility for that, and they are shamed by that. So
it's a great analogy.
Yeah. It's not that
somehow we know they're wrong to take responsibility, but they do. Mm-hmm. There's a wonderful story. The whole book isn't so hot, but there's a wonderful episode at the end. Richard Wright novel called The Long Dream. And he's got this character who has been an American all his life and has expatriated himself. He's a brilliant, brilliant guy, and he's studying at the Sorbonne in Paris. But he goes crazy. And he walks around like this, as it's described, because he thinks he doesn't touch the ground. And somebody says, Woody, you're nuts! And again, this guy's a genius. He says, I know. Every time you turn around, you think there's somebody after you, and you know there's somebody after you because you've got all the consequences of somebody being after you, but then when you turn there, you can't see anybody. And so you just know that there's nobody there, it must be me. And meaning me that's created all of the inferiority, the idea of inferiority, all the ideas of what we have up here already too. So you either break out in violence, or in Woody's case, you go nuts. Well, another dimension of this. And we'll see what you think of this one. I'll go fast. And I'll skip up to get to some ideas that are a little more abstract. I have said, my master found religious sanction for his cruelty. This is a good one for Christians. As an example, I will state one of many facts going to prove the charge. I have seen him tie up a lame young woman and whip her with heavy cowskin upon her naked shoulders, causing the warm red blood to drip. And in justification of the bloody deed, he would quote this passage of Scripture. He that knoweth his master's will and doeth it not shall be beaten with many stripes. Feelings, thoughts.
I have a feeling of cringing.
Yeah, okay, yeah. One of the things that we... Justification is the word I'm going to write on there. And throughout the 19th century, but, you know, we can look then and see, is it part of us now, too. We look for something to justify this kind of behavior, this way of life. And historically, I suppose the major things that Americans went through to justify this, all of which, read James Baldwin, he'll tell you, all of which failed. And that's one of the reasons America is so screwed up psychologically as a country, in terms of its identity, in terms of its racial interaction. But the justifications failed. Justification number one, we need them economically. Justification number two, they're heathens. Justification number three, they are uncivilized. Well, those of us who have studied anything about African music, I mean original African music, know that African music is probably more complex than European music. Well, that says something about civilized and, you know, and barbarians and those kinds of ideas that got labeled. Then we're gonna make these heathens Christian. We already know something about that, especially as somebody mentioned with our treatment of American natives, you know, and what religion is really the most barbaric and so on. And then there was a thing called... they tried this kind of pseudoscience called phrenology. You ever heard of that? Where they just check the bumps on your head. Yeah. And blacks apparently had, I mean, this is the whole theory of this thing, fewer or more, whichever it was, bumps. And, well, therefore, they're not as intelligent. Well, then that was disproved scientifically. My point is, all of these different justifications all failed. And in the end, and this is what America as a country and we individually probably have to deal with most, in the end, it's irrational. And we can't justify it, and we can't explain it. It's irrational, and that's a pretty tough thing to live with. Here's one that's, I'm skipping up so we can do this. What do you think of this? He's escaped now, and he's living in the north. I'm going to cut this down to just one line. He goes to a meeting of the... abolitionists and anti-slavery people, and he's an escaped black. There are free blacks who are bought into freedom, but who can be put back into slavery any time. Somebody just rip up their papers and send them back. This happens to a guy named Olato Equiano in another slave narrative. That's a good story. He buys his freedom, and he shows his papers to some guy, and the guy just says, "Give me those." Just tears them up, puts them on a ship, and says, "You're my slave." And that's all there was to it. So buying your freedom was not really such a big deal. Well, Douglas is free, and he goes to this meeting, and there's a black guy who is turning in, he's getting money by turning in other escaped slaves. And at the meeting, somebody stands up and says, "We know who he is." This is the preacher, the Baptist preacher of the city. "We know who he is, we know who our traitor is, guys, take him outside and kill him." And he just stood up there while they grabbed this other black guy, took him outside and killed him. I suggest to you one thing about that. The resort to violence, in the sense that violence and freedom are linked together, and we know that historically too. But here's the philosophical thing that Douglas says in just a short sentence. "The motto which I adopted when I started from slavery was this: trust no man." Now, what's your reaction to that? Black or white? That's why I told you the story about they took the black guy out. Trust no man. How would you like to live like that?
Isolation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Talk about alone and alienation. Mm-hmm. When you walk in, whatever your job is, you walk into that job, you just assume that people trust you. And you assume that you can trust them. I assume that nobody put arsenic in the hamburgers today. And I assume that when I come to a green light, I can go, and the people come in the other direction, they're going to stop. Well, those are silly examples, trivial ones. But then make those serious that you trust. I assume my doctor is going to give me his best attention and his best, most intelligent diagnosis. And I assume that when I go to the hospital, I can get the best treatment. And we know historically what happens to the black people there. Well, one last thing to get to this, and then we'll let you, we'll see what we can accumulate together here. This is from Linda Brents. Incidentally, her real name is Linda Jacobs, Harriet Jacobs. She writes under the name of Linda Brent. This was written in 1845 first, then was lost for over 100 years. Some woman found it in the 1980s, researched every single name and place in this book, in the book that I first bought with this, was about this thick, verifying every fictitious name that Linda Brent, and that is the fictitious name in itself, uses to make the historical connections. So this book, all pseudonyms, but all historically true, verified in the number one edition of The Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl by Harriet Jacobs. The book we have here, and which is the one you should read, and it's not full of 100 pages of footnotes, is Linda Brent's. Here she is. Here's her situation. Linda Brent, to avoid the sexual harassment of her owner, she is apparently, as she describes herself and as other people say, she's a very attractive young woman. She's about 17. And he whispers things into her ear all the time about sex, and she can't stand it. It's clear from this book that she has a very strong Christian moral code, and that's how she's going to live. Her grandmother has taught her that. Her mother, who died early, taught her that too. And it's a real living thing for her, and her master is absolutely repugnant. Besides that, he's ugly. But it's not the issue. It's her morality. Finally, he says to her, I'm going to build a house for you out behind here, and you can live there, and I'll take care of you. And you either do that, or I'm going to sell you down the river. Now, all slave narratives tell us that the number one fear was not of being beaten, not of being raped, but of being sold. Separation from the places, and most especially the people that you love. So that's her option. Be put up in this house and taken care of nicely by her master, but submit to his sexual lusts when he wants to, or be sold down the river. She goes out and she finds a black free man, has sex with him, and she's pregnant. She tells her master, you can't bother me anymore. Well, her grandmother thinks this is absolutely awful, that you chose to submit your body sexually outside of marriage instead of living, she disowns her. And Linda Brent goes into quite a story about the moral choices that slaves are forced to make. Well, here's the end of that scene. I wanted to send for grandmother, and I did so, but days of agonizing suspense passed before she came. Had she utterly forsaken me? No, she came at last. I knelt before her and told her things that had poisoned my life, how long I had been persecuted, that I saw no way of escape, and in an hour of extremity I had become desperate. That's the whole sex thing with it. She listened in silence. I told her I would bear anything and do anything if in time I had hopes of obtaining her forgiveness. I begged of her to pity me for my dead mother's sake, and she did pity me. She did not say, though, I forgive you. But she looked at me lovingly with her eyes full of tears. She laid her old hand gently on my head and murmured, poor child, poor child. What's your gut feeling about that? That's the last episode. Put together words like this, morality and autonomy, self-definition and self-determination, and your own philosophical, theological outlook on life. So one of the questions I ask students at Augustana is, name the ways you can be enslaved and go way past shackles on your wrists and your ankles. And slavery's tradition and slavery's legacy leaves us with these complicated dimensions of life that go all the way into our most profound spiritual relationships. There's a wonderful scene in there where Linda Brent wants to pray, and she has to stop because she feels so unworthy. Verlaine said, shame. She's not right in accepting the blame for this awful choice, but she can't get rid of the guilt. And it has, and you know what it has to do with. Any comments? Or do you see how this relates to our own, most of us in here are white, our own struggle with racial issues and our own struggle, you know, that's within us and that's between us as we look out there at the people of different race and try to...
I think the feeling of having been a slave is so very important within the African-American communities. Today, I have a friend who cried when Rodney King was, when the people that beat him were found not guilty, and a feeling of hopelessness.
Is your friend white or black?
He's black.
Yeah. I saw white people cry when that verdict came out. Mm-hmm. And I was one of them too. And then I had a friend who saw the video after, I don't know where he'd been, but saw the video after the verdict, and he said, I can't believe it. No matter what the situation, how can that be? Oh, yeah, okay, anything else?
It just seems to me that racism is just this crack that runs through the soul of America.
Mm-hmm.
And unless we can come to terms with that, it's like we're doomed.
Yeah, and come to terms with it, it's a good phrase for it. And one of the things that the American intellectuals of the 19th century thought, here's a little English literature lecture, sorry, I got 1 minute to do this, is, you know, Emerson and Thoreau, the guys we call the what? The transcendentalists, the big leaders with ideas of oversoul, and it doesn't. They pretty much thought that individual goodness could transcend evil. And that the institution of slavery could, and the evils of slavery could be destroyed by the individual goodwill of our fellow humans. Well, we know how successful that was. I mean, they were around in the 1820s, 30s, 40s, 50s, and then kind of the Civil War, so that didn't work. And I mentioned that intellectual approach, that is, that the individual's heart must be changed, to suggest to us that historically we know it's got to be a two-pronged idea. Or a two-pronged attack, I mean. And one is on the individual heart that is sick with racism, and that's all of us. We all have racist feelings and attitudes, and that, but that as we begin to recognize them, we can rise above them. And before I continue this, I'll give you an example of Harry Truman. Harry Truman threw the word nigger around. He didn't want niggers in his house. He didn't want them in the offices. He didn't want them in politics. And he's the guy that got the Civil Rights Bill started. Because he knew that the sense of law and justice was bigger than his own prejudices. So he recognized his prejudices, he lived them out, and he thought that those prejudices can't be as big as law and justice. That's what I mean by, even if we can't get rid of those racist feelings that we have, we work on that, and we struggle with that, but we can, as we begin, we get clearer and clearer on our own racist ideas and attitudes, we can pose them against ideas of justice and law. That's one thing, that's individual, that's one prong on the fork. And the other one is to struggle with the institutions that perpetuate racism. So we have, I'll give you two words, this will be on your quiz, the only thing you have to remember. We have two major kinds of racism in America, attitudinal and institutional.